We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to THC. You know me, the man who calls himself the Carlwood, and I'm here to tell you that you've been lied to, manipulated, and deceived before your first breath of air. Born into a structured society of forced dependency on easily managed and controlled resources, while more efficient and sustainable technologies are reserved for the underground bases of the world's elite. Fortunately for us, Higher Side Chatters, today's guest Stan Deo has traversed the world beyond top secret security clearances and hidden sciences. Working on anti-gravity saucer-shaped craft and free energy systems, he's now spent the past 30-plus years telling his amazing story and schooling the people on the hidden hands that have replaced the world of what could be with the world of what could be controlled. He's the author of three books, most famously The Cosmic Conspiracy, a lecturer, educator, and a brilliant mind. I couldn't be more thrilled to have him here. Stan Deo, how are you?
Hi, Greg. Good to be here. The bio sounds better than real life. That's good. I ought to run for politics, hey.
Right. I will write your speeches.
Sounds great. So what are we talking about today?
Well, you know, your story is so profound because it sheds light not only on the secret technologies of the world's elite, but also how they absorb anyone who comes across these technologies independently. And I know you've been telling this story for decades now, but please tell the people how you got mixed up with James Maxfield, Edward Teller, and their Black Ops projects in Australia.
Okay, well, back in 1971, I was working in Dallas as a senior systems analyst at a conglomerate of about 100 corporations had dealings with illegal arms trade, et cetera, in the Middle East as one of their operations. And I was an undercover informer for the FBI there. And while I was there, I also worked on some of my own research into propulsion and aircraft. And I had a blackboard. I had a private office, and I had a blackboard that swiveled. And on one side was company business, you know, for them. And the other side was Stanley business when I was having lunch or whatever. Because we worked long hours, sometimes, you know, 20 hours a day, and sometimes we didn't get to go home. So I had to do that if I wanted to get any research done. Anyway, I don't know whether someone peeked at the other side of my board when I wasn't there, but I was approached by a senior officer for one of our corporations. When I was having coffee down in the canteen for the staff there in the building, and it would hold about 1,000 people, so it was a big canteen, and I was the only one down there because it was in between, you know, coffee breaks or lunch breaks for the troops. I just went down to get a cup of coffee and be by myself for a minute, and this guy comes in and comes over and sits right in front of me. There's a lot of other tables, you can imagine, with 1,000 seating,
right?
And he comes over and sits right in front of me. I didn't know him from a bar of soap, and he introduces himself, and I said, oh, you know, I'm glad to meet you, you know. And I'm thinking, oh, well, there goes my silent time. What are you doing? What do you do here? Yeah, I told him. And he says, you know, are you doing anything, you know, as a hobby? And I said, oh, yeah, I work on propulsion, alternate energy and stuff at home. What kind of stuff? So I told him. He said, oh, that's very interesting. You ought to go see a friend of mine, Dr. James R. Maxwell. He'd be very interested in talking to you about that. And I said, oh, yeah, well, thanks. And we got up and finished our coffee and went off. And about a month went past, and I sneaked down to have another private coffee. Darn if this guy didn't show up again in an empty canteen and come sit in front of me again. And he was European, one of those SKI type names. I know who it is, but no point in pointing him out here.
Sure.
And he put his cigarette between his second and third fingers, you know, like they smoke it in the movies with the spy movies. And he's talking to me over this smoke, and he says, you haven't been to see my friend, Dr. Maxfield. And I said, no, gee, sorry about that. I've been a bit busy. He says, well, you will go see him this afternoon, yes? I said, oh, well, I have an appointment for you, 3 o'clock, over here at this address on Lemon Avenue. You go now. I thought, oh, well, all right. And then I got thinking as I went upstairs, this guy only appears when I go down there. I mean, what, are they monitoring me or something? I mean, what is this? And
right.
Then I'd been working on a flying saucer design at home, and it was an electric flying saucer, but not anti-gravity per se. I thought, well, maybe somebody knows what I'm fixing to do. I was going to file a patent on that. So I went to this Dr. Maxfield's office, this radiation research facility, and there were no cars in the parking lot, just all in this long building, and it didn't look like anybody was there, no sign of activity. And so I opened the front door. It was one of those creaky doors, like that. You look down this long, dark hallway, no sounds of life inside, and the only light you see about halfway down coming through a window from the side. So I went in there very quietly, walking through up to that light to see what was going on here, you know, getting really creeped out. And on the right side there was the receptionist desk, and there was no one there. And the light was coming from a window over her desk. And then all of a sudden she came out from a side room. She said, oh, hi. And I said, oh, hi. Look, I think I'm supposed to meet a Dr. Maxwell. Oh, yes, Dr. Maxwell's waiting for you. Just wait here a second. She runs back into some double doors back into the lab. And out he comes with his lab coat and cowboy boots and big cigar stuck in his beak. And he says, oh, howdy, boy. I'm Jim Maxwell. Oh, glad to meet you, sir. And come to my office. So we go in an office. And in this office, all around the sides of it are photographs of him and Dr. Edward Teller, and like when he went under the pole, they had a champagne ceremony for him, first time under the pole in the submarine, and all kinds of awards and diploma stuff on the wall. And he said, sit down, boy. And I said, well, I don't know really why I was told to come here, but how can I help you? And he says, well, why don't you tell me what you're doing at home in your lab? And I said, oh, well, knowing that I was in the presence of a guy that's got that many degrees and a friend of Dr. Right. Teller's and security clearances out to Wazoo, I thought, well, anything I say is going to sound stupid. But I said, well, look, I've been working at home on a way to make a saucer-shaped craft, use charged air particles to accelerate it, where I kind of combine electromagnetism and electricity and gravitation. He said, look, don't beat around the bush. You're working on anti-gravity. I said, I am. Well, okay, all right, yes. And he said, well, we're a little bit ahead of you. We've already got it. I said, oh, who's we? Dr. Teller's team and the rest of us, and we've got facilities all over the planet. And I thought, wow. So we want you to join us in our facility down in Australia. And without boring you to death with the rest of the details, it took several months and medical exams and people flying out from San Francisco from the Australian consulate to examine me and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they promoted me to electrical engineer, even though I didn't finish my degree. And I was immediately paid and things were settled in my house, and everything was settled up. And my wife and I and the children, we had to go and tell no one where we were going. And at this time, I was starting to really get creeped out. And so we had flight reservations for a Sunday. About a week ahead of time, I decided to take the family and leave a week ahead of time, move the ticket exit date up so that if my plane was going to crash or burn, I wouldn't be on it,
mm-hmm.
And we sneaked down to Australia, and then as soon as I hit Sydney Airport, where we landed first, it was in the wee hours of the morning, it was still dark and no one in the airport at that time. In those days, it wasn't 24-hour airport. And we got out, and I was standing there, with bags in tow, and in the middle of this dark airport. And an airline captain came up and said, "Oh, hi! What you guys doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm waiting till sunup till we catch this flight down to Melbourne." And he said, "Oh, look, let me fly you on my flight. I can take you down and beat that." I said, "Well, can you do that and change my ticket across it. No problem. So when the lights came on, he did that, and it was another way to hide my trail, and I jumped that plane and went down to Melbourne. Eventually, I met my control agent down there, Captain Sir John Williams, and they had me write a paper for the aeronautical research labs down there in Melbourne on my a plasma propulsion system. And I came to find out within the group that they didn't really like Jewish people, and they hadn't researched that my father was Jewish, and so I didn't bother to tell them. But they were definitely anti that, and they didn't want me to make certain things public, like our alternate energy thing, which is similar to the one that Dr. Morey developed in Utah in the 30s. And similar to the one that Ayn Rand wrote about in Atlas Shrugged. But anyway, they told me that I couldn't talk about those things, even though they weren't to do with propulsion. They were things they already had. And they didn't want the public at large to know about these things. And I really couldn't see a reason to keep some of this technology secret as far as propulsion, or sorry, as power, from countries that needed to pump water to survive, you know, for the villages and stuff that were poor. And they said I didn't understand that, you know, the way they had it planned, there were going to be hundreds of millions of people that will die by natural attrition, by dehydration and starvation, and that they wanted that way to reduce the population. So that was the time I got my first awakening to the fact that the powers that be, whoever they are, really were planning on culling a lot of the human race.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we kind of – they knew I disagreed, and they put all my files together, all my – the stuff that wasn't terribly – well, some of it was classified. But anyway, they put it in a box, put it at my front door, and their driver there told me, you're on your own now. We disavow any knowledge of you. You're out. And they then made it known that through another one of their operatives here that – they wanted to put me at the bottom of a mine shaft, you know, kind of permanently. Hmm. And so I got wind of it early enough to organize an escape and left Melbourne, went bush. And in Australia, that's a big place, bush, about 85% of the country is bush. It took me several months, probably 6 months, to make it clear across the country to the other side, to Perth. And there, under the protection of... under the protection of what they call ASIO, the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, I was able to stay and not be harassed by those that were chasing me. I did manage to elude one agent from our government that was sent to kill me in the desert, and he let me go when he caught me. But anyway, all those things led up to me eventually writing a book, The Cosmic Conspiracy, to expose what was going on. And since I was protected there in Perth, it allowed me to... do television, radio, and documentaries, which, you know, most of them are filmed there, some in Europe and parts of it in the United States. So they couldn't really disappear my presence without kind of raising, you know, more attention to their problems. Mm-hmm. In the late 70s, I learned from other members of the group that had since left the group, retired or whatever, that somebody had moved in on the group and our base is underground and under the pole. And had taken over our technologies and kicked us out, kicked us being the humans. There were some pretty weird ducks apparently that were non-human per se.
Right.
On our basis. So that's the basic background of what we're talking about.
Sure. And I want to get into that, but at first, at the risk of getting too technical, would you mind explaining the way anti-gravity and energy density work to allow the UFO-type crafts to exist and move the way they do?
Yes, it's in the beginning with the charged aircraft, saucer craft, there were two direct currents involved in the atmosphere around the craft. And actually, some of it penetrated the crew as well. But these currents were at right angles to each other, and they produced what's called a Lorentz force. And in the early days of the saucer technology development, the kind of nickname for a saucer craft was the Lorenzo, Lorentz-O, meaning a circular toroidal craft with these twin direct current pulses going through it. You can see an example of this by taking a glass of salt water and putting a nail on, hooked to one end of a battery in the center of it, and putting some aluminum foil in a strip around the inside of this glass of water so it forms a loop, and hook that to the other side of the battery, and you'll see immediately bubbles form, but they will spin in a vortex as the what's called the Lorentz force occurs between these. And you have to put a round magnet around that as well. Sorry, a north-south magnet up and down. But we did it with test tubes and stuff to show people originally. Mm-hmm. So it spins, and when you have a spinning fluid like that, you virtually make a flying tornado around your craft. You can extend this into a pulse field of high voltage without using the ionized air. You can actually do it through the crew, through their body, through the atoms of the craft, and in the air around you. And when you pump that field up, it generates an invisible stacking field that's like a spinning donut with a vortex or a tornado in the center of it that recycles around the craft. Mm-hmm. And that acts against gravity and gives you an altitude. Then if you deform that field with other fields impressed upon it, it will make you go left or right or backwards or forwards, anything you're going to do direction-wise. By controlling both the density or the strength, let's say, of the field that's spinning and the impressed directional fields, you can raise, lower, and go in any direction you want. Those kind of craft will work in space without an atmosphere and go interstellar or interplanetary. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of enough, or you want more?
Yeah, well, one thing I've heard you describe that was just super interesting to me is the way a UFO, to us, it looks like it's making a super sudden, high-speed, 90-degree turn in midair. But inside the craft, to them, that probably takes 10 minutes. They have time to prepare, secure their notebooks, take a seat.
And turn the corner after they've drunk their tea and had a game of cards.
Right, so this technology also affects time.
It does. You can't cheat the physics of the universe that we understand anyway. If you're going to turn a corner at 20,000 miles an hour, under normal physics and time, what would happen is you'd crunch up your ship. Your ship would break up from the inertial stresses, and your crew, of course, would die.
Right.
You're looking at G-forces, above 15 Gs. You'd weigh like 15 times your normal weight. You'd just squash up against the wall. Mm-hmm. How did they do this? Well, they found that when they pumped up this field with energy, the field would go out away from the ship, maybe 800 feet in diameter, and some of them 400 feet in the smaller ones. And that if they let that energy pump up, it also pumped up the atoms of the crew and the craft itself. It increased the energy of spin in those atoms so that everything was uniformly raised in its energy level. Now, it's a bit like helium atoms compared to normal atmosphere. The helium atoms will, rise to the top, whatever. Mm-hmm. But helium atoms dart around very quickly. Now, the atoms of the people, the crew, and the craft itself are traveling along, let's say, at 20,000 miles an hour. You're going to turn a corner. Well, to change the corner, normally what you do is you take advantage of the fact that you're going to go around that corner at 20,000 miles per hour, a time unit. And we found that if you took that time unit and amortized it by letting the energy density of the crew's atoms become more dense, mm-hmm. is time would slow for them inside the field. You get ready to make a turn, you charge them up, you make sure everything is all equal density, then you change the direction of the craft. Well, inside the craft, as you go around that corner, it'll look like you were saying, 5 to 10 minute break. We're going to turn a corner and, okay, everything will slide one way with about 1G toward a wall or whatever. And you're sitting in your chair and you have your cup of tea and whatever.
Right.
And as you finish the turn, then you don't need to have that energy density. They release it in a burst of energy, which becomes like a flash of light. So people will see these things go dart here, dart there. And quite frequently see that burst of light in the visible spectrum as they throw off the energy they don't need anymore. But they have amortized. They've amortized over that 10-minute period the change in direction. And so by doing that, instead of being 20 Gs, let's say, in one fraction of a second, it's amortized over many seconds. And so the G-forces are then much more acceptable to everybody on board and the craft itself. While you're down on the ground. It, of course, as it turns that corner, it's in the blink of an eye and it's gone. But that's how it happens. And so, in essence, the craft of the crew, the more of these turns they make, they age more than their twin brother would on the Earth, because every time they go into that dilated time, they are still aging and their bodies are aging. And when they come back to normal time, they've lost, you know, let's say 10 minutes in that turn. They've aged that, whereas their twin hasn't on the Earth.
Yeah, that's just fascinating to me. I think that's super interesting. And the fact that it was worked on in the 1970s and even earlier probably is just insane. But I know you saw a lot of various technologies with your work in Teller's group, but if those technologies you saw in the 70s were fully rolled out to society, what would be the implications and the practical applications of some of these technologies?
Boy, well, for one thing, if people had alternate energy, you know, like the little thermionic boxes or the antenna boxes, we wouldn't have the control over the planet by the existing power structures and petroleum and coal and nuclear. It would be virtually everybody could have their own home power unit, which mm-hmm. vastly changed the control of people across the planet, because as long as they've got power at their house, independent of any network or government, people don't really have to participate in the overall government of a country or world. Mm-hmm. And the control would be lost. So obviously we'd have either mass civil war and going back to tribal structures as people overthrew the overlords once they got that energy or those devices. Transportation would have been vastly different. We could have openly been exploring the moon and asteroids and nearby planets with these craft. We could have taken a lot of the production of things that are producing toxins here and done it in the moon, for instance, and come back to Earth and not, you know, have pollution here. You can have doorways in solid metal or solid walls that aren't there, and yet you turn on a field which activates a pattern around that portion of the wall you want to go through, and it polarizes the atoms of yourself and whatever you're wearing or carrying, so that they form a matrix, and so does the wall. And it allows your matrix to slip through that matrix without touching. Because the average wow. average distance between atoms is like, you could squash it down 1,600 times before the atoms would touch, although you don't realize that, but that's what it is. So it's a matter of making a matrix out of your body atoms and matching to a matrix in the substance you're going to go through, and then just pass through it. You can also, like in a saucer craft with a metal hull, you can put your twin pattern strips in the shape of a door on the inside of the craft, and it's solid metal, right? Mm-hmm. And in these two strips, there's a zone that you can produce a particular kind of pulse frequency that will allow the atoms to separate at, you know, one atom separate from the other without cutting a hole. You don't lose any material. It's a lossless cut, and you fire this up, and it cuts a doorway out of the metal, out of a solid metal wall. And if you have a spring-loaded or hydraulic system attached to that portion of the wall and back around where the door would appear, you can then spring-load that door, put it out, and you walk through it, because it's now, you know, not connected to the ship's wall. And you go out, do your business, come back, and then you close it to where the cutout piece of metal is lined up with the wall again, and change the frequency 1.5 cycle, and everything works, you know, reconnects all the atoms.
Repairs. Wow.
You've got a solid wall. And these are things that are like science fiction writers have talked about for a long time. But some of that kind of technology would definitely change the way the world is today. We could produce food day and night in smaller areas. And we could produce it in hydroponic systems and things like that so that we don't have pollutants in it. We wouldn't have a lot of the greenhouse gases and things that are just a normal byproduct of us living and our livestock living and stuff like that. Genetic engineering, another thing that's moved way beyond where we are in the public sector, mm-hmm. Where you can engineer away diseases and genetic defects in people. So, you know, there's a lot of technology that's gone way beyond what we knew about at the time, but that's some of it.
Yeah, that's frustrating, you know? It's really frustrating that such a positive thing would be kept under wraps. But outside of your personal experience, can you give us a bit of history about this group you were involved with, their agendas at the time? Like, are they operate above governments, I'd assume? And then I guess the events surrounding the loss of control of some of these facilities.
Well, the popular name for this group of individuals is the Illuminati.
Right.
Certainly since Adam Weishaupt formed the Illuminati within the Masonic Order in Bavaria in 1776, something like that. I forget when it was, in the 1700s. But since he formed that, and then since that group was allegedly disbanded and everybody put in jail, nobody knew publicly about the Illuminati any longer. But what we have is, in the Western world, a group of super powerful, rich families who have a lot of money and hence power, control the flow of energy to the people, like oil and gasoline, natural gas and that kind of stuff, and coal. Mm-hmm. These people at the top do talk to each other in their directorships of these large corporations and family trusts. They sit, cross directorships sit on somebody else's trust and back and forth, and they pass information back and forth that way in these meetings. Now, the group that Dr. Teller was working with, they were a multinational group. The Chinese weren't exactly a part of it, and neither were many of the Arab Islamic countries. Teller's group were like the Judeo-Christian Western thing, and more Christian than the Judeo side of it. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to deplete the oil reserves, and hence the power of the Arab oil-producing countries, and China as well, and Russia. They wanted to Russia now. They wanted to deplete their ability to manufacture weapons and to compete in the economic market, so that the Western nations could control the planet with our style of government and our philosophy. To that end, various things like the free energy devices were capped off, because they wanted the world to use up the energy in the Middle East, and if it wasn't being used up fast enough, burn the fields, like in Iraq during the Gulf War. And then the next thing, of course, is to have a war in the area, which nukes those fields so that they are irreparable for a long time. And it's hard to spin sand so that they would weaken the Islamic nations, or in the Middle East, particularly the OPEC countries. This government, or this association under the government of the world planners, included people from Russia, like Dr. Andrei Sakharov, but the Russian government put him under house arrest when they found out he was involved in this group. Mm-hmm. Dr. Teller in our country, we had another fellow in England, and one in Canada, New Zealand, Australia. Most of the major countries in the West had representatives on their directorship, and they were either engineers or industrialists, and some bankers. So all of these worked together in concert toward this one world government under the Western style. And the hundreds of millions of people that they were going to eliminate were primarily in Asia, not so much so in the United States. Well, at least at that time, anyway.
Right.
And see, one document, I had a courier, a CIA courier, that had a handcuff to his wrist, and without going into a long story, I was able to see his open briefcase and actually pull out the document he was taking back to Langley, to where they were going to allow 100 million Indians in Asia to die by withholding grain loans at the right time. And it would look like nobody's fault, but they would still die from hunger. Mm-hmm. Now, that's, I laid eyes on it, and it was a real document. So anyway, these people, these engineers and scientists and Teller's group, had facilities they'd buried underground, and in one case under the South Pole, you had to get to it by submarine. And people just could not get down inside these underground. They couldn't spy on them from above ground, like everybody thinks Area 51 was a big deal. You're not going to see anything above ground that you aren't meant to see. So with all these underground facilities, they were sharing them. Now, I'm going to tell you hearsay now, because I never met an alien in my life, at least Noah.
Yeah.
They told me that we had joint facilities with these alien critters underground, and we're jointly developing technologies in exchange for the alien critters to do tests on human beings and that kind of stuff, which gets into a whole other discussion. But in the late 70s, Teller's group, all across the planet, lost control of their facilities, these underground bases. The alien critters revolted or kicked us out. And I think it was because simply that they had built up our infrastructure underground so that they could manufacture the technologies they really wanted to do without sharing them with us, so that they could have a weapons facility there and other things they would need to take over the planet, not from us so much, but from what the ancient biblical records talk as the Son of God returning through a parallel dimension gateway. You know, I guess the best way to explain it, this great battle is coming, and they needed to have technology that they weren't allowed to gate through when they came through the gates, which I think was probably called the Tower of Babel in the ancient legends in the Middle East. Is that...
That is super interesting. I mean, I've heard before that I believe Eisenhower had met with some Greys. I've heard that story before, that rumor going around. There was actually, I believe, a retired congressman who came out just recently and said that he saw a document that they had had that meeting. Have you heard about Eisenhower meeting with Greys at all?
Yeah, I heard about it, probably the same source you did, but the Grey critters, they have short ones and tall ones that are mentioned in the public lore. I think that these things are really like androids or like biological robots. They seem to be rather emotionless, soulless, and just function as a very bright computer on two legs. I think they were made for the purpose of creating an interface between the true superhuman beings, which are probably a little bit taller than we are, who came through the gates, who've been cast out of the parallel universe in a war they're having there. And they're making their last stand against the authority there, which we call God, here and in the near future. Now, to do so in a world where the Christian thrust and the Jewish information thrust has made it clear that in the last days of this age, before the long thousand-year peace reign on the earth, that there's going to be a great battle here between the rebel from the heavens and the true king of this planet. That meant that we would be looking for a bad dude to arrive, and the whole UFO situation has been engineered by by Satan. Let's call him what he is.
And you're talking about, now, when you say God and Satan, I mean, are you talking about actual entities?
Yep.
Okay. To clarify, because, you know, I grew up in a Catholic school, and I'm kind of off put by religion, but at the same time, I love things like the show Ancient Aliens. And when you interpret the Bible and some of these ancient texts that I've heard you talk about, you see them as descriptions of technology in a lot of ways, right?
Well, yeah, certain technologies and people. I mean, they're real beings as far as I'm concerned. And
right.
Like Yeshua, Jesus in the English, is a real being and will come and set the planet correct after overthrowing the satanic forces here. But, I mean, that's a kind of a very mild way to put it in a big overview. But we are all that study prophecy expecting to see an evil, bad leader of the planet, one-world dictator, the Antichrist, come to power. Expecting that. Now, if you were Satan and being as bright as he is, you would have to invent some sort of a ruse to fool the people of the planet into accepting this. Okay, just hold on 1 second.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, you'd have to fool the people of the planet into accepting the fact that these Greys are the ones that are going to try to make an Antichrist and all that kind of stuff be defeated. Now, Satan himself want to come as a messenger of light and peace and love and harmony. So he has to have bad guys for you to see being destroyed.
Right. Use them as a proxy.
Yeah, and I think it's going to go wider than just these little gray critters, which everybody's afraid of because they abduct people and, you know, do terrible things to them. But everybody basically today knows about the Illuminati and the one world government and the rich, ultra nasty people. And wouldn't everybody get excited and clap and cheer if the Illuminati were taken down and the little gray critters were taken down by this new being who comes in these flying saucers with these minions that are all happy times and look like us but are a little bit tough, maybe, and they're going to bring peace to the earth and they're going to appoint a human to run the planet? Well, hey, It's a ruse. And I've talked about that in the last chapter I added in the Cosmic Conspiracy last in 2010, it was, because it's in the book of Daniel where it absolutely tells and warns you about this. And he will pose, Satan will pose as a little g god, a creator of earth and its people. And that will fit in exactly what Daniel is talking about. He does say it will happen. So I'm warning people, look, we're going to see alien critters announced officially, and people are going to say, well, I always knew they were there. But there are going to be two groups.
Mm-hmm.
One, you know, the grays and stuff that are allegedly bad guys, who were actually built and controlled by the ones who will come posing as messengers of truth, love, light, harmony, whatever you want to call it. And they will offer us a deal that we can't refuse. Save the planet, save your lives, and peace on earth.
And obey.
And people will run to this. Once our governments are turned over to this new centralized world government and the Antichrist, obviously, things will start to change. Now, that's why it's been so important for me to reveal certain portions of the technology and what they were doing, to show you that you don't want to be fooled by the first arrival. Any being, super being, space or parallel universe or whatever, any super being that manifests here on the Earth and tells the people of Earth, you know, I'm here to save you, and it's okay, and I'll get rid of the bad dudes.
Look out.
Yeah, I'm here in the desert in a secret place, or I'm up here in orbit of my spaceship, or I'm down below in my underwater base or whatever. Anybody that doesn't come where all eyes, living humans and living animals of all kind, cannot see and recognize its presence simultaneously across the planet, any being that doesn't have that power but claims to have, you know, deity-like status, don't believe it. Because the scriptures are very specific. When the true king of this planet returns, he will be seen by all eyes at once. And there will be no going to this secret place or that one to see him. He will be out in the open for everyone. So those who hide away and try to rule indirectly from these dark places mm-hmm. are be the deceptors. And that's kind of the most important thing that I have to tell people. And you've picked a good question for me to answer.
Well, we are less than 2 months away from a time that has been prophesied for forever as being super important. I mean, we're facing economic problems at a scale we haven't seen in forever. I always hear about earth changes in the magnetic field, as well as just natural disasters. I mean, is this all related in your eyes?
Well, to start with, I think you may be referencing some of the 2012 Mayan calendar stuff, and I don't think that that is really an issue. We have other problems that are happening in the solar system and on Earth that are independent of such things. I think that we do have engineered crises in energy and hence in the weather and also in economies and in diseases. So don't be thinking that everything's coming to a head at the end of this year. We are going to increasing problems, and that they've already started. And without getting into the political situation, just the sun itself is such a serious threat to us, because the sun every 22 years goes through a complete 360 degree reversal of its magnetic poles. Every 11 years, the magnetic poles of the sun flip, and then every 22 years, they're back to normal. Now, that magnetic field stretches out into the solar system in spiral arms of like a spray of solar particles called the solar wind. And if you know what a Catherine wheel is, it's like that. There are spokes that spin out.
Mm-hmm.
He looks when it's forming. Arms that spin around like in a vortex. And we pass through those arms all the time in varying degrees of density, solar wind. The Earth's magnetic field is a matter of record. This is not hearsay, is weakening, and it is weakening rapidly. It does periodically in history weaken to the point that it flip-flops upside down and North Pole becomes South Pole magnetically. When that solar wind comes out from the sun, it has a proton, you know, a positive charge. As we react with that on Earth, if our magnetic field becomes so weak that it's unstable and can flip upside down to match that of the sun, then our pole will shift. And I think it will shift on one of those 11-year periods. Right now, we are approaching that over the next 12 to 18 months, where that polar magnetic reversal of the sun may affect ours and flip ours upside down.
Hmm.
And we're seeing drifts in the magnetic field, a severe drifts, more than we've ever had in recorded history, in human history anyway. So,
how would that affect people if the Earth's poles were to flip-flop?
Well, it's the transition period that's dangerous, because although the magnetic field will not go to zero, it will weaken and start to wobble and flip upside down over a period of weeks. During that time, our upper atmosphere, the ionosphere and the Van Allen belts will weaken. And these are our, like in Star Trek, these are our shields for the planet to, mm-hmm. to
shield the sun.
From gamma radiations from deep space, from the sun, and, you know, a whole range of frequencies in the ultraviolet. When we're weakened, when our fields are weakened, these will penetrate to a much greater degree. And having been in under an ozone hole myself in Australia and felt it for the days that it was there, I tell you what, it does hurt the skin. It's like needles hitting your bare skin. And it's so bright that your eyes cry, you can't stop it when you're out in the sunlight, even with sunglasses. This is going to be all over the planet in roving fields as the transition occurs. But that's not the only problem. The sun itself is doing something most irregular as far as we're concerned. You know, human scientists, they have this this method of analyzing data, which looks at what's happened before and therefore supposes it will happen the same pattern in the future. It's called post hoc ergo propter hoc in Latin. And that means it's always been doing it this way, therefore it will always do it this way in the future. Not so with the sun. Since 1992, solar physicists have realized they don't know a thing about the sun, really, as far as its internal mechanism. Mm-hmm. In 1992, two new spectral bandwidths in the ultraviolet range came out and continued. And we're now starting to get bursts in other little bandwidths that are abnormal. And we're getting some really impressive solar flares this particular cycle as we approach the peak. And even though we measure cycles of the sun by the number of sunspots we see, we don't measure it by the intensity of the emissions that come from those sunspots, nor do we measure it by the area of the sunspots. And so you can have fewer sunspots with larger surface area and emissions of solar flares that would cook our planet. And that's a situation that would not follow the normal sunspot number curve, which people try to tend to base their analysis of the solar cycles on. Mm-hmm. We're approaching right now within months the beginning of something with the sun that may see the sun throw off a lot of heavier amount of atoms all over the surface of it.
Wow.
To the point that it's in a dark cloud of debris that it's released.
What do you think within a year you think this is going to happen? Or are you pretty confident that this?
Watching the next year to 18 months because of this peak in the solar sunspot cycle. I think that we're going to see the Hale magnetic cycle trigger this. If you do, and get this, there's four or five places in the Bible, Old and New Testament alike, that predict that the sun is going to be covered by a cloud so dense that when you look at it, you know, from the surface of the earth, that it's like looking through a sackcloth made of hair that has little pinholes of light coming through it, but the rest of it's dark. Hmm. And at the same time, that the moon will be turned to a blood red color, and not actually blood, but a blood red color, because of the diminished light of the sun coming through that cloud. Now, how long this lasts, I think it's 2 or 3 weeks. But even the Hopi prophecies predict the same thing.
Right. I've heard you talk about meeting with the Hopis and that they are actually preparing in some ways for this type of situation. Where do they get their knowledge from?
Well, it's been passed down to them for over 1,000 years they call God by a different name, by Masau, but that he descended in his light craft and talked to them and gave them prophecies to the prophecy keepers within the Hopi to pass from generation to generation until certain signs happen and they could release the information to their people and then eventually to the world at large. So they had direct revelation by some being.
And they're preparing for this that we're talking about now within the next 12 to 18 months?
Well, I don't know what their time period is, because when we asked the same question you just asked me when, they said soon. And
sure.
We joke about it, Hopi soon. they think they'll be underground for maybe 2 to 3 weeks, and it will be very hot on the surface of the planet, burning trees and grass. Now, let me also say that not all of the Hopi do this. The Hopi have a large percentage of Christian Hopi versus traditional Hopi. they differ on the interpretation of prophecy. So when you say the Hopi are doing it, some of the Hopi are, some are not. And let me just draw that line so we don't get sure. in trouble. But they have been building underground, like kivas, like mud igloos to weather the heat, and putting away beans and corn stored in wood ash so that they will preserve for up to 30 years. And water, anyway, water is very precious there in the desert where they are anyhow. So,
wow.
Going to happen. We're definitely seeing in the immediate future something is going to happen in a lot of areas, and the sun is going to be the main driver for the weather or climate events.
Well, in the cosmic conspiracy, you actually mentioned weather weapons. Do you think these are in use today?
Yes. Since the mid-70s, the United States and Russia, for instance, have openly talked about signing treaties to limit the extent of weather warfare. And in those days, weather warfare was could be something as simple as spreading coal dust over Siberia from the air to make snow melt earlier and change the weather patterns over Alaska and the northwestern United States as a result of it. Those were early attempts, and those were specifically mentioned into weather alteration and seeding of clouds and that kind of stuff by Martin. Mm-hmm. Now, the HAARP situation is not controlled on a planetary scale by any one group. Chinese have their version, the Russians have their version, we have our version, and I think there are a few other ones popping up now in some of the smaller nations. The problem is that even with just three, you know, Russia, China, and the United States having these technologies, and not just one HAARP transmitter, but several per country, when you start to manipulate the upper ionosphere to heat it and to cause various lightning strikes and storms in other places, if all of you are trying to do something at the same time, the results become unpredictable because they will interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You're using the same upper ionosphere to transmit your signals. This is not good. And it is possible to steer hurricanes simply by heating up the air on one side of the hurricane, even a tornado, so that it pulls one way or the other. So rather than start the hurricane, you can accelerate it or bend its path to a certain degree. It's like taking a water hose and you've got it on a solid stream coming out of it. You can take your finger and touch the side of that stream, and you can make it deviate several feet on the end of where it strikes just by a little amount of energy on the side of the stream.
Right.
And the HAARP type control is that kind of a thing where your finger's the HAARP signal, and it can touch the side of a huge weather phenomenon like that and cause it to deviate from where it was going to go originally. There are other factors, I'm sure, that affect the weather, but these are the major ones, the upper ionosphere and the amount of solar radiation that we absorb. And to that, let me address this also. The chemtrails that we see in the sky, which are not really contrails, they are particulates in suspension that are exhausted out from expended fuel and jets.
Mm-hmm.
Things. I've heard people say that because they found gels that had come out over certain areas, that they were trying to kill people, the test virus or whatever. And this may have been the case over a very small test area or something. I don't know. But in the main, what Dr. Teller proposed and filed patent for was to make an aerosolized metal vapor, in essence, that would suspend in the upper atmosphere to reflect the sunlight in certain areas to help control the weather over areas to cool them rather than let the sun overheat them.
Mm-hmm.
This was the original intent, but there have been other intents in that when these artificial clouds cover an area, especially with metallic vapor in them, it's hard for satellites to penetrate it to see what your troop and equipment movements are when you don't want it to be known. So there are a number of, you know, pluses in the chemtrails, but they are definitely not normal, and they are primarily applied to weather control.
Sure. Well, as far as you know, are there any clear, distinct differences between man-made and natural weather events? Because you hear there are some people who think every single natural disaster is the result of a covert battle between countries. And then you got other people who don't think that's even possible. So is there any way that we can, any clues we can look at to discern if it was man-made?
You know,
or manipulated?
I don't know what they would be because, they're using normal things, like they're using clouds, they're using hurricanes and tornadoes that are normal.
Right.
The drought situation is a function of the change in the jet stream a lot of the time. Do we have a way to plot the HARP data or the HARP transmissions real time and see whether they've interacted? I've not seen something that allowed us to see everyone's HARP signal being interpreted on the planet. That might be nice if we could. But other than that, I think that you just have to deal with it and say, well, somebody caused it, either by weather or by, you know, normal change in the Earth's ecosystem or environmental systems. Mm. This change of the magnetic field is not a small thing. Look, in 2005 and 4 and 3, I was tracking solar flares and stuff like that and how they affected the Earth and its magnetic field and its charges. And as part of my research into how we could predict earthquakes. And on three occasions, I found we had a large Earth-directed solar flare occur. And when it hit the Earth, it produced an energetic ball of heat inside the planet that bounced up, in one case, over 600 miles in diameter in the Northwest Pacific, just south of the Russian peninsula there and north of the Japanese islands. And it was there for 24 hours, then it disappeared, and it reappeared in a smaller form over in the South Atlantic as it bounced around inside of our field. So the sun itself affects the temperature of our oceans and our magnetic field. And I'm not so sure that we're not going to see a big increase in Chandler's wobble, the Earth's axis wobble, in periodic outbursts that then return to normal. We're getting reports in from Alaska and some from south of us here on certain days that the sun does not set in the right place, but it rises in the right place. So we've been trying to get hard data from these people and train amateurs who see this stuff to give us exact bearings, time of day, so in GPS location, so we can verify it. But there's something really unusual happening, and it's not all man-made. We mm-hmm. don't the planet. You know, that's a big task.
Right. Well, you know, you're kind of touching on something that I wanted to ask you about. Science seems to be taught almost as a belief structure in itself, and that new concepts that don't fit into the established framework are sort of ridiculed and dismissed, like your anti-gravity technology or some of the things we're talking about now. Do you think that is a natural human tendency, or do you think there is some manipulation in the scientific education community to keep people away from these technologies and concepts and understandings?
It's both, because if you'll think back, every generation, the older generation resists the change of the newer generation, as, you know, balderdash.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this from generation to generation, even back in biblical times. However, using that as a natural occurrence, there can be an artificial cathedral of science established, which, you know, makes its worshipers accept what comes from the political or scientific pulpit, as it were, in the cathedral of science. And I think that there are definitely, I know definitely that there have been a number of technologies that have been suspended or held back from the public in the interest of the public good long term. And you can justify this if you're a one-worlder saying, look, we're trying to do what's best for the human race to allow the biggest portion of the human race to survive what is coming and to not destroy itself in a nuclear war and et cetera, et cetera. I'm convinced that a lot of the Illuminati that people talk about, at least in mid-levels, are really good-intentioned people thinking we're doing what we're doing for a good cause and we're holding back information and technologies for a good cause in the long run, because if we release it too early without global control, it could create a war that would end the planet. Hence, mm-hmm. So it's a very hard thing to just simply dismiss out of hand as they're the bad guys. And having worked with some of these guys, these old cotton top cigar smoking port sipping gentlemen, I can tell you that they think they're doing the right thing.
Wow. Let me ask you, and we kind of touched on free energy earlier, but you find all sorts of YouTube videos of people claiming to show you how to make a free energy generator at home. I mean, how would you do that? Do you think that some of these videos are legit, or are these people just blowing smoke? Because a lot of my friends who have taken some heavy science courses in college, they don't think this is possible.
Well, I haven't tried all of the advertised specials online.
Right. I've
seen a few of them and looked at their hype and decided these guys are hyping people. The amount of energy they're talking about supplying, you know, are the ridiculous amounts. And if these were real, they would just simply publish and let people have it. There's no point in trying to make a buck off of it. Everything that I have talked about in developing the moray system, I've made public. And even the patent office helped in when I applied for a patent on it in 2007. They said, we're not going to grant you a patent because we don't think it'll work. And yet they turned around and the U.S. Patent Office presented my patent application for the first part of the circuit free to the public when they're supposed to seal them as an application that did not get go to patent. And it's on the internet now. You can look it up. And certainly I tried to patent the most important part of the device so that I could not be prevented from giving it away if I wanted to. And then when it was out there, well, I just said, all right, it's there. And I give lectures now then and tell people, okay, here's where the energy is. Here's what you need to do. And that way I'm sure that when I die, at least the knowledge of that doesn't die. It's out there.
Right.
Other scams that are out there for dollars, you know, look, I'm not going to participate in that game. If people can't produce the power structure at home themselves and safely, there's no point even telling them about it. There are three ways, maybe four, that I've found that are safe ways to get alternate energy out of the Earth's environment. One is thermionic conversion through a photoelectric device that converts infrared energy, like heat, but radiated heat, into electricity directly through a chemical compound. And they do make semiconductors that do this. In fact, I was just talking to one of the companies yesterday, but they're only in the amount of, you know, maybe 1 watt worth of power, if you're lucky, and not in the thousands of watts that you need. Mm-hmm. Then there's the there are several methods of taking electrostatics out of the atmosphere and taking wind and converting that to high voltage to drive a Jeff Amenko type electrostatic motor generator coupling. There's the moray device, which takes the whole secret of it is a resonant antenna and converts that into usable AC for your home. All these things I've discussed, and you know, it's I wouldn't trust any of these things or waste my time on the "you too can be energy independent" type promos on the internet. Mm-hmm. Balderdash.
Sure. And another thing, kind of off topic, but I've heard you mention the Philadelphia experiment in passing, which is a legendary story. What do you think? Is there any validity to that story? And what do you think happened there?
Yeah, there's some validity to it. I actually talked with Townsend Brown before he died when he was living in Catalina Island there off the California coast. And I discussed this with him after Bill Moore had written the book about the Philadelphia experiment and claimed that Townsend Brown had done this and that. And Townsend told me, he said, look, Bill Moore got carried away and exaggerated a lot of this stuff. But here is the story. It was World War II. And there were very tight budgets for R&D projects for like radar deflection and stuff. Mm-hmm. Our submarines and our surface craft wanted to be able to get close enough to German coastlines without being picked up by German radar. And so they were looking for a way to bend the radar pulses around them so they didn't return back to their sending base and paint them as an object on approach. Now, the millions and millions of dollars that were going into the Manhattan Project, you know, took money out of some of the more exotic experiments that people wanted to do, in particular the Philadelphia experiment, which was meant to build a field around a ship so that it could deflect radar signals. So the researchers looked for a way to convert an existing technology that was already built somewhere and convert that to a field that would deflect these electromagnetic signals. They found that by converting a minesweeper, like the Eldridge class, that it already had coils wrapped in all three axes around the ship so that they could control the magnetic signature of the ship in waters that were potentially populated by magnetic mines. They could control the magnetic signature of that ship so it looked like normal water and it wasn't a magnetic hull passing near the mines, which would cause it to detonate. The researchers realized they could take those field coils, modify the direct currents that they were, you know, that was supplied to them by the generators below decks, and they could generate a field that would wrap around itself and stack up like the layers of an onion, and over a period of a few minutes would become a very strong field that would spin the electromagnetic radiation that hit it around to where it went. It wouldn't come back to the sending source. Now, electromagnetic radiation is visible in the light range to our eyes. The radar is visible only to equipment picking it up. They didn't think about this field bending visible light as well. And when they did fire it up, it did just like we're talking about with the saucer craft. It dilated the time inside the craft or the field on the Eldridge. People were, you know, moving around at normal speeds to them, while outside everything else seemed to freeze. If you looked over the deck toward the water would be moving around the bow, but, you know, a few hundred feet out, it was still. It wasn't moving at all. Only within the field were things moving. And it was like a dilated time when you turn a corner at high speed. And that's why they got that strange report of the Eldridge appearing 2 minutes after it disappeared out on the test area, back at its base there at Norfolk, and a glowing light bulb in reverse, and then it got the glowing field stopped. And as the guard was looking at it, he noted the time, and it was 2 minutes after they had disappeared, you know, offshore later, they found. And men were running around on the deck like ants in a hurry. And that's because they were still in accelerated time. On board, the crew realized they were in trouble because parts of them, as they were shutting the field off, were stuck in the metal. And one guy burned, another guy went into extreme slow motion as the field, you know, started to dissipate there. So they turned the field back on and chugged back out to the test area to try to figure out what would happen out there if they went back to the same place and turned the field off. That's more to the truth of the Philadelphia experiment. It was an accident.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if they had these technologies decades ago, I know you're not directly involved anymore, but where do you think these things have gotten in 2012? Can you even speculate?
Oh, it'd be hard because, I mean, look at what we've done publicly since the invention of the horseless carriage. We've, in less than 100 years, gone to the moon and back and built atomic power and bombs. And, you know, if you're talking about this kind of technology over 50 years privately, Lord only knows what they've got.
Right. Well, when you see a UFO, if someone sees a UFO today, what percentage of those would you speculate are piloted by aliens versus humans? Do we still have that technology, or has it been stripped from us, in your opinion?
I think we may still have some. I saw one a couple years back. I was up in Colorado Springs for lunch, and I did see a small silver ball up overhead, a bright one, dart in toward NORAD into the clouds. And it was definitely not one of your normal aircraft at the speed it moved. I think that was probably one of ours. But as far as anything serious to threaten the quote-unquote alien presence, I think our options are limited because the fallen ones, the aliens' ability to detect what we're doing is so advanced that I don't think we can keep secrets from anybody in that group. I mean, even with just a simple Moray-type device with a standing wave field, Dr. Moray in 1935 could fire up his antenna over his house and his device and tune it a certain way, and he could hear people talking 5 miles away simply because their voices modulated the field and he picked it up and amplified it on his radio. With that kind of technology advanced to now, I'm sure that people looking for bugs in their house or their office or whatever are wasting their time. No, you don't have anything. The field just goes through and you can read it. So how do you hide an underground base doing electromagnetic research and stuff? Do you make a Faraday cage? Well, is that going to get rid of all the detection possibilities? I don't know. At this point, we really, really need help from a good guy with the technology to defeat these guys. And that is the true king of this planet, you know, Yeshua. But without that, we haven't got a chance. We can't do like they do in the TV and movie series V, because we're not going to trick these aliens by sneaking on a little shuttlecraft and blowing up their craft. Or
Independence Day, where they upload a virus.
It's not going to happen.
Right. Well, I've heard so many people talk about this, so many witnesses that have seen or, you know, heard about these covert wars with aliens in our underground bases. And when I talk to people who haven't heard about it, it's such a hard pill to swallow for them because it seems odd that an alien race would be able to come down to a planet they're not familiar with, infiltrate these bases, one of which, you know, in the South Pole is only accessible by submarine. I'm sure they obviously could use other technologies to get there, but how do you see it possible that these aliens could get down to these, you know, secret societies without ever being exposed or captured on film, exposed to the masses?
Oh, I'm sure there have been proper leaks and photos and reports that went to the masses, but have been thoroughly discredited in the, you know, the post-event operations in the news and whatever, and with disappearing. The super beings that we're talking about are not just from some local planet or some nearby galaxy or whatever. These are beings from a parallel universe. Einstein postulated mathematically and openly in philosophical discussions. The Babel, the Tower of Babel, which is Bab El, Bab meaning doorway and El meaning God, was a doorway to the gods, just like in Stargate, except it wasn't going to a faraway system. It was going to a parallel universe. Now, that allowed these beings who are having a war in their universe to resolve the war in a virtual reality created here on Earth when mankind was created. And it was for control and the structure of control and where they come from. These are evident in the Asian records and the Middle Eastern records from the ancient days. The gods, little g gods, fighting each other with super powerful weapons over the Earth. And this is really a courtroom here. And there are violations of courtroom procedures that have occurred apparently over the ages. But still, it is a virtual courtroom where damage here doesn't affect the parallel universe. This is coming to a close shortly. And even some of the long-range prophecies of the Bible prophets do say at one point in time, the earth and the heavens as we know it will pass away out of existence. And a new heaven and a new earth will replace it. And I am reasonably certain from what I've studied in the ancient languages that we've translated direct ourselves, there is going to be, and there is now, a difference in energy density between the parallel universe, the levels there, and us, so great that eventually our level will be consumed into that as fuel, if you wish, into its order. Examples, angels in the early days, or you know, gods appearing to man, came in flaming chariots and fire and heat, and an angel appeared personally to a person. It was warm and bright light around them.
Right.
Demons, ghosts, when they appear, the room gets cold, and they're at a lower energy density level in the existence of things than we are. So there's a level, there's levels of energy density. Lower ones are cooler to us, higher ones are hotter to us. And one example, again, in the Old Testament dealing with Moses, he was up on Mount Sinai, and he was there by himself, and he was he'd slipped his sandals off and was not lifting his feet but scooting them across the dirt because God told him, you have to do this to keep from being zapped by my presence. In essence, the field density had to be normalized so it didn't build up with insulated, you know, leather soles or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Moses says, look, I want to see who I'm talking to. You're just a voice. Let me see what you look like. So God says, look, I can't do that right in front of you. I can't stand in front of you because my energy would destroy you. But I can project my image on this cloud, and I'll hide you here. Get up here in this crack of the mountain where you can't be hurt by my energy, and I'll project on this cloud so you can see what I look like. And that's how he showed Moses without hurting him. Now, after that time, I don't see any records of God appearing or angels appearing, you know, in chariots or whatever to mankind because it was too difficult. You know, it was too dangerous for our flesh to be exposed to the radiation that accompanied it. These beings are not just local travelers. They are parallel world beings, and they were here at the creation of the Garden of Eden story. And even that tells you in the ancient writings that there was a pre-existence on Earth before that time. So the Earth can be much older than 6,000 years, as you know, some biblical students tend to think.
Yeah, it is interesting to hear you talk about stories that I heard about in the second grade and in Catholic school with a twist of science behind them to sort of explain what was just presented to us as essentially magic.
Well, it's no insult to say that it's the blind leading the blind, because if you don't understand the technology, it is magic.
Right.
If you're not a magician or even understanding the magician's tricks, how can you explain it to anybody? You don't understand it yourself. We're fortunate to be in this time and have access to the knowledge, if we just use it, to properly understand what they were trying to explain to us in their own crude ways thousands of years ago.
Yeah, let me ask you this. We're kind of getting down to the end of it, but what do you think the next 5 years look like? You kind of touched on it that you know, the Hopi are preparing for increased heat on the planet. Are we going to end this covert war is coming to a close? And within 5 years, do you think it'll be possible for anyone on the planet to deny the existence of some multidimensional or extraterrestrial beings?
No, it won't be possible. I think that they'd have to be, you know, in a comatose state to not accept it.
You think this is going to go widespread within, like, you know, fairly soon?
Yeah, it has to. And when it does, people will be faced with choosing the right side. And the dark guys, or, you know, the bad dudes that don't have our best interest at heart, are going to, let me just put that, the idea will be to choose between the good guys and the bad guys. If you don't know the good guys are coming, then you're at a loss, because you'll follow the first super being race or whatever that appears and says, we were at the crucifixion, we're really the, you know, the good guys, and trust us. I can see that coming to the forefront, where people will just be absolutely stunned by the revelation of their existence in the next, you know, 5 years or so. In addition, we've got political problems here in the United States, in that no matter who wins this election, it's so close and tempers are so frayed that we're going to see civil disorder as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And this means that martial law will probably be attempted to be put in place. The Hopi also told me that it was going to happen, in that there was going to be a terrible, multifaceted civil war in the United States among the non-people, the non-Indian indigenous people. And the civil war would destroy many people, but there would be survivor groups from that would migrate down to the Hopi, and where the Navajo and the Hopi are, to join with them to form a new tribe, which would then move up into the Four Corners into Colorado. So they're expecting the same thing, and when you ask them, it's soon, Hopi soon. I think that day is certainly approaching. We're a country so divided, and so many polarities between economics, between race, between religion. It's just, you know, gangs and non-gangs, drug users and non-drug users. I mean, and they're armed. And so we're going to see a terrible, unstable time where people will die in this country alone.
Given that we do have, you know, some the age-old argument about, do we have free will, or, you know, are we, you know, shackled to prophecies, how is it, what's the mechanism behind these situations that are allowing them to manifest in such detail as, you know, you just described with the Hopi?
Well, you know, all I can say is that there must be a being who can, or group of beings, I mean, depending on your viewpoint, they can look forward in time. And I mean, we can do that now in a crude way with our computers and put data into it and forecast what will happen, but not to the degree that we could forecast thousands of years of human potential interaction to come up with an answer. But I'm sure that left for 10,000 years of development, we'll probably come up with a super, 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 super artificial intelligence that could analyze data and say, this is what's going to happen, and could project decisions and genetic reactions, that kind of stuff, to the point that we don't even know exist at this time. And that would allow you to see future events and to tell people in this time about it. There may be another way to just simply look ahead in causal effects in our universe from one up above it, in energy, and you can actually see events without having to make a computer to do it or anything, and can then report it to beings in our time to get ready for it. And even that, even the reporting of the events, affects future events. So it's a very interesting time paradox type situation. But when you see things happen that have been prophesied for so long, then you know that there's some mechanism that allows a being, an intelligence, God, creator, to tell you what's going to happen, and to not be in error. No matter what you do, it will happen this way. And that's including your reactions to the alleged prophecies or situations around you. All that's been taken into account.
It is a fascinating mystery. That pretty much does it for my line of questioning, Stan. I mean, it's been a real honor, a real educational talk, and I hope we can have you on again soon in the future. I mean, your website, which is always full of interesting stuff, is standeo.com. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about that you're working on?
Well, I am working on that energy situation to try to get it to a workable stage for people, so that I can tell how many feet of this wire and that thing that you need. And At present, I'm working on a way to make a high voltage diode without depending on, you know, high tech manufacturing. So, other than that, that keeps me busy.
Sure.
And so does the phone, Greg.
Well, I'll let you go. I know you have other interviews to do, other things to get a hold of. So, thanks again. A real honor. Appreciate it, Stan.
Thank you, Greg.
That about does it, Higher Side Chatters. I hope you enjoyed Stan Deo's company. Check out his website, standeo.com. If you got the time and want to hear more about the technology, check out The Secret Technologies of the New World Order on YouTube, I think is what it's called. Awesome, awesome stuff. Here's another track, a dominant song, a revolution rap by Rev Delic again this week. This one's called The 99. Remember to support the Higher Side Chats through conspiracies.net for all your conspiracy clothing needs, and keep your pimp hands strong.
We are the 99%. Sick of people telling us that's just the way it is. Turn the negative to positive, the cool to uncool. Re-educate your schools and make these rulers unrule. They use you like a tool and only tools get used. Only fools get fooled. But I know that's not the truth. Time to wake up the youth and get my message out the booth. You've been firing in the wrong direction. Your weapon's been misused. You can criticize my views from what they tell you on the news. But they spit it for the green and I'm just singing you the blues. And these are whose street?
Our street.
Read the picket signs. In these revolutionary times, we are the 99.
Mike check.
We are the 99. We are the 99. The 99. Occupy the world and make history.
Defeated, the revolution will be repeated and tweeted, never deleted. It's already here, believe it, we can achieve it. If you can conceive it, then believe that we can lead it. Protest, this is occupation across the nation. Revelations are documented by mainstream media stations. Wikipedia copy and pasted through internet innovations of information gathered for outrage and contemplation. It's amazing, people are waking up to the nightmare. Elites are blighting, corporations don't fight fair. Fox News got some citizens brainwashed and dumb, thinking it's charity to man a slice when you're getting a crumb. Don't stop me from fuming, corporations ain't human, but we should be pursuing a suit for the resources they consuming. We are the 99, silent majority, no longer silenced, refusing to surrender peaceful against the threat of violence.
Occupy the world and make history. Hear the cries in the night to clear these villains up. We try to use the time out of our life, but it keeps filling up. Liars try to hide from the treason, that's why they're killing us. People that's been fighting for freedom, that's never giving up. We was hoping that it never would have came to this, but the future of our kids is dangerous. Your heart, your soul, and your brain's at risk. The earth is a war zone and you're paying for it. The downfall of man is that he won't evolve. The bombs and the bullets won't let the planet revolve. Treading through a smog that will never dissolve. It's the same when you do the same thing, expect different results. They don't care about you or me, our government's bought. So we have to stand together and recover the faults. Bring the new world order and the war to a halt. And love everyone with every bit of our hearts. Occupy the world and make history.
The 99.
Revolution.
Rev Deli. Worldwide, baby.
We are the 99.
We are the 99.